Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to Beto Da Silva for driving us through the afternoon. It is Monday, September 16th, and you're listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Tony O'Donoghue has the latest on the financial crisis unfolding at Dundalk Football Club.
We'll be sticking with soccer, and Alan Colley and Stephen Kelly will review a big weekend of action on the pitch, both home and in the Premier League. Sharon Lynch reflects on Ireland women's rugby win over Australia, and Brian Keogh chats golf as Rory comes up short and Europe miss out on the Solheim Cup.
And in racing, Ruby will provide us with his Champions Festival highlights. As always, if you want to have your say, you can send us a text, 51552, WhatsApp 0871879200, or we are on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Good evening. Welcome along to the show. Welcome along to an hour of sport. Alan Colley is already with us. Ruby, first and foremost, how are you, sir?
I'm great. And yourself? Had you a good weekend?
I had a fine weekend, yeah. I was up in Derry.
You're not in Derry, no?
I was, yeah. I had a fine weekend. I had a day off Sunday. We'll talk about that. I walked the dog. I know. Had a good Sunday, Ruby. We'll talk about that. Alan Colley, how was your weekend? I'm just going to move swiftly on.
I had a great weekend, Shane, yeah. Full of football.
You didn't go to Derry.
Yeah, he did, but he's just impartial. That's the only thing.
I was in a working capacity, Ruby. So I was in Tala Friday night in a working capacity, and I was in Derry on Saturday, and I was in Sligo yesterday seeing the family. So I had a great weekend.
Good. That is great to hear. Come here, Ruby, you were at the Champions Festival.
We had a great weekend as well.
Yeah, a successful Champions Festival. Ruby probably had the best weekend out of all of us. I know, Alan, you clocked up a bit of mileage there, and you got to see some decent football as well, albeit a bit one-sided on the Saturday, but however. How was the Champions Festival, Ruby?
Oh, it was a great weekend. Shane, great race, and a couple of English winners. One French winner yesterday afternoon, Gavin Hernan, an Irish man training in France, won the Tattersall Sales race. That had a bit of flavour to it. Obviously, we had Japanese runners as well, but it was great racing. I mean, the Champions Stakes on Saturday afternoon was a cracking race. Economics, Auguste Rodin, the Japanese runner, Shim Emperor, Los Angeles. You were hoping that you get a really good contest. I mean, went to the four-long pole with chances, Luxembourg's on the inside, and to watch Economics battle back on the Tom Marcand to chin Auguste Rodin. Shim Emperor, the Japanese horse, looked unlucky. He got caught in the pocket when they turned at the 5 furlong pole, and Los Angeles got caught too far back. He was following Auguste Rodin, but it was just a cracking race. And I mean, third and fourth could easily go and be really competitive in the arc. I mean, Economics looks like he'll go to the British Champion Stakes. Auguste Rodin will go back to America. It was a cracking contest. And then you had the Matron Stakes before that, a double for Tom Marcand. For Dunnock O'Brien this time, he won on Porta Fortuna, who's been a revelation this season. She was a good two-year-old, Shane, but since her defeat in the Guineas, she's just gone forward. She was brilliant at Royal Ascot. She won the Falmouth at Newmarket. She's after winning the Matron. But again, a bunch of an American syndicate owner, that the diversity in owners across the weekend was incredible as well. They were American, obviously, and just the enjoyment and the pleasure they got out of it. You had Green Impact winning the KPMG Juvenile Stakes for Jessica Harrington. Shane Foley rode him, owned by Mark Chang from Hong Kong. Then you had the Blandford winner, Johnny Murta, Hanalia. Shane Foley rode that, Yega Khan. It was just incredible diversity, spread of winners and spread of owners, but it was a really good weekend.
Is that strange to see the international flavour and such a broad spectrum?
It's what the sport needs to be, and obviously when you've a home, it is a home game for us, and when you have somebody playing at home, which is Aidan O'Brien, arguably the greatest trainer in the world, when he's having a home game, you do kind of expect that he's going to dominate. Now, he did have four winners. Kyprios won the St. Ledger, and Diego Velasquez won the Solanaway. They were the two ridden by Ryan Moore. Fighter won the Patingo Handicap under Wayne Hassett, and Lake Victoria won the Maidlair under Wayne Lorden. But look, obviously Joseph had two winners as well. O'Brien, Dylan Brown McMonagall rode both of them. Trust Your Instinct, owned by JP McManus, and he won the National Stakes when Scotty Champ won. But it was outside of that. You had Ger Lyons with two winners. He won Chantez, won the Inglebell Stakes. My Mate Alfie won the Bow Lad. Colin Keane rode both of them. And he won the Northfields, the last handicap for Emmett Mullins on This Song Is For You. And you had Ronan Whelan riding two winners. He rode that French winner. He rode Dance Night and Day to win for Ross O'Sullivan when he won the Sovereign Path. Johnny Feen and Nathan Cross won the Autumn Fillies and Mares handicap with Vera's Secret. And then you had Bradsell, who just looked like an absolute bullet in the Flying Five. I mean, he looked like a top class sprinter. They were clocking 43 miles an hour as they headed by after going 2 furlongs. They were flying. and they kept it up. They broke 58 seconds at the Curragh. That's rapid. He's a proper sprinter, that Bradshaw.
Wow. Ruby, I'm always asking you about the best of the best, but just a couple of, I suppose, the upcoming ones. Tom Marquand, where's the ceiling for him?
There is no ceiling for him. Look, Ryan Moore sets the standard in flat racing internationally, you could say, but it's, you watch, and to me, Alan, it's the lads who aren't afraid of him. You watch Tom Marquand in the Champion Stakes, and it was quite tactical early, but Tom Marquand was the one who kept reacting to the situations as they were all unfolding in front of them. And people say in sport, you know, who thinks the most? Well, in racing, it's like every other sport. If you're thinking, you're losing because you should actually be reacting. If you're stopping to think about something, that's only 1 second, 2 seconds, it's gone. It's your reactions that count. And Tom Marquand's reactions in the Champion Stakes were top class. All his reactions were the right ones, and he landed himself to win it. But there is no ceiling for him. But you watch Shane Foley, Colin Keane, Dylan Brown McMonagall, you know, even Ronan Whelan with his double. There was good riding all across the weekend and very few disappointments. I mean, you want them all to turn up, and that doesn't usually happen in racing either, lads. Like, the only Bedtime Story was the only horse that was went as favourite and didn't turn up. She completely blew out. You could say maybe Purple Lily was a bit disappointed, maybe Henry Matisse. But when you get 17 races and you can only say three horses didn't perform, that'll just tell you the quality of the racing that was on offer at the weekend. And there were two good days. I think the big winner was the Curragh. The Curragh has struggled since its redevelopment, and it struggled for crowds, it struggled for atmosphere. But I must say, yesterday afternoon, there was a great atmosphere there. There was a great crowd. Now, the two official attendances lead you to believe there was more people in Leopardstown than at the Curragh. That's not the way it felt. Maybe the Curragh is more compact, so it carried a better atmosphere. But I would have put my hand on my heart and said, I was caught in traffic on Sunday. I was never in any traffic on Saturday, getting in or getting out. Nine races definitely didn't appeal to the Irish race score. It's too long a day. That was there for Whirlpool, but that definitely didn't work because the people left Leopardstown before the last three races, which are the handicaps and supposed to be the big betting races. But the Irish punters, they didn't stay for them. So Leopardstown needs to have a look at itself. It was quite quiet. There was a good crowd for the Champion Stakes and an atmosphere for that. But outside of that, it was definitely the lesser of the 2 days, and it shouldn't be. They should be on a par. And Leopardstown, with its urban venue, where it's situated, should be full. It way underperformed. Leopardstown needs to have a good look in the mirror. But the Curragh, and everyone loves to knock the Curragh, but I must say, the Curragh are getting it right. They've turned the corner, and fair play to the people down there. They're doing a great job with it.
Good stuff. That's very interesting insight, to be honest. Out of all of that then, just briefly before we move on to our football chat, one highlight of the weekend, Ruby, I'm assuming it's Champions Festival related.
The Curragh was brilliant to see. It was great. But look, I know I'm a Kildare man, but yeah, I'm traditionally a National Hunt person, but to watch the Curragh, you could feel it the last couple of meetings there. Okay. The locals are starting to go again. There was a family vibe. It was a great atmosphere. That was one. But you want the Champion Stakes, which is the flagship race in Ireland. You want it to be a good race, and you got that. You got it with Economics, Augusto. Then, obviously, Shin Emperor, the Japanese horse, was a huge addition, and he had Los Angeles. It was a cracking contest, Shin.
Great stuff. Alan, briefly, sporting highlight before we catch up with Tom.
Arsenal's performance yesterday.
Okay.
It was so solid, so brilliantly executed in terms of the defensive display that they put up. An art that's dying in football, and everybody wants to play out from the back and play the lovely football. Arsenal are capable of that as well, but sometimes you have to go away from home and suffer. And I thought their execution and how they defended, the distances between all the players, the shape of the team, it's no coincidence that they have the best defensive record, and they look like a team to me who's ready to win. And I thought it was brilliant.
Grinding out results, sign of champions and all of that. Saturday was so deflating, I didn't have a sporting highlight. Niamh Farrelly banging in a cracker for Piemont, I think, in their win. John Bellew scoring a last minute goal for Lucan over Nafina. It's all very Dublin centric. Or actually, before the Arsenal Spurs match, the Arsenal mascot calling out the Spurs mascot for shaking hands with the Arsenal player.
Like Alan, you get the feeling he sat at home all day yesterday with the curtains pulled, don't you?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, and I'm not surprised because I saw the performance Trevor put in.
Well, listen, some Dundalk fans might have been sitting at home with the curtains closed because it hasn't been great for them. With rumours of liquidation and everything else in the club up in the air. Tony O'Donoghue is standing by. Before we chat to Tony, Tony was speaking to a few very important characters. Daryl Horgan, current player with Dundalk. John Murphy, former player and first. Orla Crilly from the 1903 Dundalk supporters group.
I think it's really important to any investor that he sees the fans of Dundalk. They're not just buying that thing, they're buying into us, and we are passionate fans that will work tirelessly to make sure this club stays alive, doesn't go to the wall, and that we have football to go to for the rest of the season, for next season, for the years to come, for your kids, your grandkids, and for everybody that's here. I know how much you all love the town. Come on, the town!
John Murphy, ex-Dundalk player, captain of in 1963 to a league title, Tony. My thoughts tonight, very sad thoughts, Tony, to see the situation the way we're in now at the moment. We've gone through some wonderful times with, go back to Joey Donnelly, my times, Alan Fox, Stephen Kenny now, you know, a lot of people. It's come to this, which is, I suppose, the wrong end of football.
You've heard that there may be a reprieve, that there may be some new investors come in the next 24 hours. How does that make you feel?
Oh, and I'd be delighted with that, Tony, because Friday night to me is like going to Mass years ago. It's a way of life now, and I'm here at 86 years of age, and I'm enjoying every minute of it. And I think it's very, very sad to see the club in the situation it is.
Darrell, the situation at Dundalk Football Club, from a player's point of view, how difficult is it knowing that, you know, the club could have gone out of business?
Yeah, look, very, very difficult, you know, kind of hard to fathom, really, in a sense. Especially, you know, I suppose any club, but a club like Dundalk with such kind of rich history, obviously in existence 121 years, and a good fan base, you know, so much going for it, and all of a sudden you're coming to a point where, you know, what's it, 14 league titles, group stage Europa League twice in the last, what, 10 years, so yeah, you're kind of thinking, how has it come to this? But look, at the moment it looks like there's a bit of reprieve and there's a bit of something might happen. So we just have to keep hoping that something good will happen.
So that was Darrell Horgan, John Murphy and Orla Crilly speaking to Tony O'Donoghue, who joins us now. Tony, as you mentioned there in your questions to those three people, there is a reprieve, I should say, for Dundalk Football Club. What is the latest?
Well, we hope there's a reprieve, to be honest with you. The owner of the club, the current owner, is a Dubliner, an Irishman based in Boston. It's Brian Ainscough, who was formerly the owner of Kerry FC. I spoke to him this afternoon, and he said he was hoping, he was in talks with a couple of groups, and he was hoping that there would be a successful resolution. Now, there's further reports since that it might be down to one group. But, you know, we talk about hope. The reality of the situation is the best that Dundalk can hope for is to enter administration and to suffer a points deduction. They're already bottom of the Premier Division, suffer a points deduction and be relegated. And that SCARP, as it's now known, it's like old-style examinership. It's a small companies administration rescue package, SCARP. So it's basically admin for small business. It has to be under 50 full-time employees. And it'll save Dundalk to a point, but you know, administration is a tough process to have to go through. You got 45 days to do deals with your creditors. Among the creditors will be the players, of course, the likes of Darrell Horgan. Now, the PFAI tell me that they'll be willing to assist in any way they can to keep the club alive, but that's what we're talking about. It's either liquidation and it's over, and if the club is liquidated, don't think that another club can suddenly rise like a phoenix from the ashes and play here in Oriel Park, because the current lease is with Dundalk FC in its current guise. It wouldn't be in New Dundalk or whatever they might want to call it. And the new club, if such a thing were to happen, cannot apply for a licence. The licensing system, we thought it was robust, but the FAI admitted at their AGM on Saturday that a more robust level of financial due diligence should have been carried out. There was due diligence of the previous owners, who were Andy Connolly and Stat Sports. The company then went into Brian Ainscough's hands in December. And, you know, lessons have to be learned. And, you know, the club is in trouble. The 1903 supporters group paid for the bus to Waterford and the meals for the players. There's a GoFundMe group. But here we are again. And, you know, it's an indictment of Irish football. I'm sad to say that we've seen it before with Limerick, with Monaghan, with Cork City. And now one of the most famous clubs in the country, who've won the league 14 times, won the FAI Cup 12 times, the last time only in 2020. And I suppose the turmoil that they've gone through since then. Remember when Peak Six, the American investment group, took over, and they still got to Europe. They still won the league under Vinnie Perth. But all the behind-the-scenes stuff, you know, there was an Italian, Giovagnoli, who was taking over. He was plucked from an American college system. No, very nice man and a good coach, but he didn't have his licenses. So, you know, the likes of Shane Keegan had to come in and help. There was all sorts of nonsense going on, really. And, you know, a club as big and with the history of Dundalk shouldn't be going through this. And outside Oriel Park a short time ago, just around the supposed 5 o'clock deadline, you know, over 100 fans gathered. It was remarkable to see them and the solidarity that they showed, and, you know, hoping that this club can be saved. Now, I don't know who put on that 5 o'clock deadline in the first place, whether it was Ainscough or the club themselves, but he's obviously Boston based. It looks like they're talking to other American investors, although I heard that there was a group with European base as well. But they're hopeful now that over the next few days the deadline has extended, if you like. But as I say, rather than it being hopeful and good news, the news is like the best Dundalk can hope for is relegation and to try and make deals with their creditors.
Okay, for now, very well surmised, Tony Dunhill. Thank you so much for taking the call. Alan, just briefly before we get on to the on-field matters, because there was some cracking FAI Cup football and indeed some League of Ireland matches, and there's Galway Rovers to look forward to this evening as well. Minister Thomas Byrne has said that there's $500,000 that Dundalk were seeking to develop the pitch and lights at Oriel Park, and the government will be bringing forward this announcement to help the club at this critical juncture, just to mention as well, which is a bit more positivity. But one of Tony's points there, he mentioned Monaghan, Cork, there's Kilkenny City, there's, the list goes on and on and again we're talking about this, and even the licensing was about a club that was owned in November and then it was taken over in December, and yet we have another crisis story in the League of Ireland. It's just utterly disheartening.
We never learn, Shane, we really don't. And I'm going to read you out a quote, and this is amazing, Ruby, when you hear this. This is from, obviously, the AGM was held at the weekend. Tony touched on it there about the FEI admitting that there wasn't full due diligence. Listen to this quote, it's mind-boggling for me, Shane. The licence was granted for Dundalk Football Club in November 2023 for this coming year. The club then changed hands in December 2023, meaning the financial checks ahead of the 2024 season, which is now, were done on Dundalk's previous owners.
That's so, tell you what more baffles me, lads.
So listen, Ruby,
the government are going to invest $500,000.
Well, that was ring-fenced, to be fair, earlier for...
But they're still going to stick it into a club that mightn't be there this time next week.
If it's alive, it said they're only going to give the
money. Yeah, they say there's stipulations. That isn't just going to be handed over.
And it's grants for a load of sporting clubs around Rugby.
Well, that's okay.
It's badly needed, obviously. That's one of the major problems.
I'm not saying it's not badly needed, but surely it's needed where something is going to be playing, not where there's no one playing.
No, I'd say that they'll have to be similar to the there was a GoFundMe set up at the 1903 that was going to match the operations. I think it's €360,000 to see out the end of the season. There will be ramifications for all of the other League of Ireland clubs in terms of points being wiped out and then the league table getting rejigged as well. But Dundalk's future in general, as Tony mentioned there, it isn't going to be just a case of playing Dundalk Town come out of nowhere. Mm. This will be left without a League of Ireland club. Derry, Cork, I think even Galway, other teams have been able to come back as a phoenix club,
but that's the point, even Shane, even more so with this. When I read out those quotes, it says also, we recognise that we're not unique in this situation. It's quite common in leagues across the world that juncture there wouldn't be the same degree of financial due diligence because of what we've gone through in the last 10-15 years. All the teams that you've outlined there, it's even more on the governing body that we should be so stringent with owners and background checks and due diligence on all this kind of stuff. To think that the licensing process was handed out in November, and just because a new owner takes over in December, he doesn't go through the same rigors of just because they were already awarded the license. And here you are 6 or 7 months later and we're dealing with this scenario.
I think, to be fair to the FAI, I think they did acknowledge that it was the loophole and that they will be looking.
But that's not a loophole, Shane. That should be something that we should be so all over as an organisation. To me, that's not a loophole.
Listen, we could spend the whole show talking about it because it is a topic that I'm sure will rumble on, and we'll cover it on tomorrow's game.
We have some argument anyway.
Well, I won't be here. I'd love, as much as I'd love a row with you, Ruby, and a constructive conversation. Marie will be back tomorrow to have an argument with you, Ruby, so I'll be tuning in. On the pitch, Alan, big wins for Bowes, Drogheda, Wexford and Derry. What was your standout from the FAI Cup quarterfinals?
Yeah, big wins for those ones. All the favourites won, which we would have expected, maybe not in the manner that they did, because interestingly enough, they all scored four goals on Friday night, all those teams in those three quarterfinals. But they, all those favourites were expected to come true, and they did. The big one for me, and you won't like this, Shane, but Derry's performance. Although Shelburne never played to the standard or the level that we've, that they've reached to get them to the top of the league, I thought Derry were very, very impressive. Ran at worthy winners, quite comprehensive winners in the end. It could have been more, to be honest with you.
They could have scored four like the other teams.
And it was a bad night at the office for Shelburne. I suppose the question afterwards, we're all looking at in terms of how big a psychological blow will it mean for Shelburne going forward in the league. I think it is a blow, but I still think if you were to say to Damien Duff off the back of, with 7 games to go, if you were to say to him at the start of the season that you'd be 4 points clear with 7 games to go, he would have snapped your hand off. The only worry and concern I have for them, Shane, is the current run of form is not very good. They've only won once in the last 7 games. There's been 4 draws in that.
That was against Dundalk.
and also, if you look at their goal return, they've only scored 32 league goals in 29 matches. The average is 1.16 across the league. They're on 1.10 per game. It's not great, and that would be a serious worry and concern, because you look at, now, the only thing that might be a little bit of, I suppose, bring solace for them is Derry have been inconsistent as well. All the other teams have been inconsistent. So if you're asking a team to close down a gap of 4 points, you'd need Derry to win at least 4 or 5 of those out of their 7. And they've been so inconsistent as well. But I just think Shelburne, their current run of form, will certainly be a worry for Damien Duff.
Yeah, big opportunity for Kevin Doherty and Drogheda again to an FA Cup final. They take on Wexford. Wexford's a really positive story. Big win for them. 4-1 over Treaty United. Plans for a 6,000-seater stadium in the heart of Wexford Town as well. So that is some positivity. And I notice Adrian Texie and Adrian Doran there, 5-1, 5-5, 2. What a performance from Wexford on Friday night. It was a comprehensive win against Treaty United. And that's the cup side of things. Before we move on to the Premier League, just on the league side of things, domestically, Shamrock Rovers were big winners over Sligo Rovers. Waterford condemned Dundalk to another defeat in the RSC, 2-1 Waterford, 4-0 Shamrock Rovers. Rovers, of course, on the road to Galway this evening as well. So Shamrock Rovers might find a bit of form as they head into Europe.
Yeah, and you would expect, we've all season, we wanted them to click into gear, I suppose, at some point, and that hasn't happened. They're another one that has been so inconsistent throughout the season, but they did play well. They went 2-0 up, and Sligo Rovers had a player sent off, Henry Francis, which I thought was a harsh second yellow card, and that was the game dead and buried then. So they ran out easy 4-1 winner, Shane. And if you look at, I suppose, the games that are upcoming, people are still suggesting they're in with a chance to win the league. They'll have to win every game between now and the end of the season, and based on what we've seen all season so far, I can't see them doing that. But I think they'll win tonight as well in Galway.
Well, if the Dundalk's points get wiped out, they'd be the big,
and that's another thing. Like, I know the ramifications for the league and for Dundalk most of all, and you heard obviously the fans speaking there that if the club went out of business it would be a disaster, but also from our point of view with the league title and points expunged, we don't want stuff like that, Shane.
No, we
certainly don't. Most certainly don't, but there'll be no points expunged. Well, maybe there will be. Manchester United's Manchester City's saga started today, so who knows, maybe there will be. But Stephen Kelly joins us on the line as well. Stephen, I'm assuming you were watching the North London derby yesterday. Spurs v Arsenal. Arsenal came out on top. Spurs had all the stats, but they couldn't get a goal.
No, why do we have to bring that up first, Rube? Seriously, you could have built me up to
I've had to endure Derry, so Stephen Kelly, you're going to have to endure Spurs and Arsenal here, okay?
Yeah, it is. It was a frustrating one. The possession, but just look, just lacking a cutting edge, which is when you have someone like Sunderland. I know Solanke hasn't hit the ground running yet. Look at the came off the score sheet, but it was disappointing. And I just think that the man of the way the goal was conceded, it's what we've seen quite frequently through Tottenham over the course of last season, and this being a little bit weak in and out penalty area year when it comes to being pushed and shoved. And you know, even though potentially I think maybe could have been penalty, I think you have to be stronger. I just think you have to protect your area better. The least they should do is come away with a point in this in scenario, and it just heaps pressure on, I think, the manager and the players. I think, you know, fans are behind them, but they want to see this passing and stuff turn to results. It was frustrating, very frustrating.
Well, you were impressed by Arsenal. You gave us it as your highlight at the top of the show. Obviously, Gabriel got the goal. You tipped him to win the Premier League. Are you still feeling as confident?
Absolutely, Ruby. Yeah, and I suppose styles make fights, and yesterday, we all know Arsenal are such a brilliant footballing side, but they went away from home and we've seen something completely different for them in terms of their defensive approach, their setup. how compact they were in that 4-4-2 formation. And it was a brilliant, it was almost like a throwback to an old fashioned kind of away performance in Europe, if you like, to go to your nearest rivals, set out your stall. Obviously Spurs had all the ball, but they actually managed the game out of possession, which was amazing. Mm. They were in total control without the ball, Arsenal, and it always felt like they were going to hit them with that kind of killer blow from a set piece, because the phrase you often hear with Spurs over the years is that they're a bit Spursy, and from set pieces, that's exactly what's happening. Last year, again, Vicario doesn't look too convincing. Romero got caught out underneath the ball. There was a slight nudge, but that's just Gabriel. You have to be stronger in that instance. And I just thought everything that Spurs threw at them, they just handled it so well. Even the players like Saka, Martinelli back doubling up with Ben White. And that's what you have to do, Ruby, to win league titles and to go away to games that you're not going to maybe have as much of the ball. And I just thought defensively they were absolutely outstanding, Arsenal. And I've said it numerous times in the last kind of two seasons, Arteta has done some job with them.
Before we move on to the other fixtures, just briefly, Stephen, 4 points from four matches. How will Ange handle this early pressure?
I'll tell us, well, by according to his interview, he said he's going to go win something. So he seems to be handling it quite well. I think he's just doubled down, hasn't he, in what he said. I think he said something, I think along the lines that he always wins something in a second season. And then he came out and said he will win something this season. So, you know, I don't think he's pulling any punches. He has an expectation on himself and the players. And I presume that people are a lot of criticism kind of thrown at, saying, no, he's going to heap an expectation on himself. But like, how kind of refreshing is it to have a manager come out and say, well, this is what I think I'm going to be able to do, and, you know, live and die by your sword. So I think if you're a player, you got to think, well, kudos to him, and he feels like there's enough in this change to go win something. So I would like to think that builds something. Maybe a few weeks down the line, be getting sacked. But I don't know.
Off the back of yesterday, Stephen, all he'll be winning is the egg and spoon race on the staff sports day.
Yeah, I don't think they're nowhere near the Premier League. Listen, they're off Arsenal, and I still think Arsenal are off City, so they're miles off that. Could they potentially win a cup? Who knows? They've been poor in the cup competitions. Like, Europa League is there. You know, they'll have a chance to get going those competitions, but they're going to have to be better. And I just think to give away cheap goals like that, you can't do that, especially on two legs or in games that are important. You have to be, let's be better.
Stephen Kelly, the voice of sense. Alan Colley, if Marie Crowe was working, they would have started with Liverpool, Notts Forest, but she's not, so we'll go there now. But I mean, how did they not win that game?
Yeah, plenty of chances, Ruby. And I think if you look at Diaz, one that hits the post early on in the game, if that goes in, it's a completely different game. But to be fair to Nuno and Forrest, we've seen it many times, no matter where he's been, with Wolves, with Spurs, we all know the way he's going to set up, especially going away from home against one of the big boys. They rode their luck at times, but I also thought they had a good defensive shape about them. And what I liked was that there was obviously an idea or a plan to bring on Elanga and Hudson-Odoi as the game was kind of opening up a little bit, to try and catch them on the counter-attack. And that's the way it played out. So from his point of view, he'll be absolutely over the moon, Nuno. Of course, Slot, it's his first defeat. I wouldn't be too concerned. I think he's done a really good job since he's come in, Ruby, and he spoke about that they'll have to be better against teams, obviously, who sit in a low block defensive shape, and they will be. But I think they had enough chances. I'd be more worried if you weren't creating the chances. I think they had enough chances to win the game, as you say. So I don't think he'd be overly concerned. He'd be disappointed they didn't get 3 points, but I don't think he'd be overly concerned. But I think, to be fair, you have to give credit to Nottingham Forest.
I think you would too. What about Aston Villa, Everton? 2 weeks in a row now. Everton 2 up and just choked it away against Stephen Kelly.
Oh no, but what a goal. Seriously, that winning goal is just
Duran.
Oh, it's ridiculous. He kind of cuts across the ball and it swerves away from the goalkeeper in the top corner. Sensational goal, but Everton, the chances Calvert-Lewin missed in the game, like, you just can't. He's gone through on goal one and one, missed
twice.
He's gone through again twice. Yeah, he smashed one across the bar, like the one that gets fed across him and he slides in. I almost think he should get there. He's looking across at the winger, but I think he needs to get there. You know, he's going to be the difference for them. But to throw away a 2-0 lead again, they must be thinking, what are we doing? And then Villa back into it. It was good to see Watkins on the score sheet. He looked dangerous. And then Duran, to be able to bring him off the bench like they have done, like, that was just, the contender, what a strike that was.
Steve, I was just going to make the point, Ruby, because of chatting to a couple of Everton fans. If you and I might be a bit disappointed with the weekend's results, Stephen, Everton fans, I don't know how they are feeling and coping at the moment. It's
I genuinely am looking at going, they must feel like the fact they're tuning up in two games, they must have thought, oh, here we go, this is it, we're kicking on, season's finally going to begin, and then to lose it in the fashion they've lost it, it's just like that. As a player, Colin, you're going to tell me as well, Ruby, if you score a winning goal that late in a game and you win it last minutes and you've kind of not really been in it, there's a best feeling, but to lose a game that way is the worst feeling in the world. They're just going to be low in the stakes belly now, and how Deutsch picks them up from this again is going to be it's going to be something else.
Well, the only thing for Everton fans is they've played four games, they've lost all four, but they're still 8 points better off than they were this time last year, so there is a silver lining for them there somewhere. Alan, what about Chelsea? Bournemouth, Everton are feeling, Bournemouth must have felt they got robbed.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I only seen the highlights because we were in Derry doing the game, Ruby, but yeah, chance after chance for Bournemouth. Now, Chelsea had a few chances as well, but I think the changes that he introduced Sancho at half time was a real positive impact, because up to that they were probably, that Bournemouth were the better team, and also in Cuckoo, that'll do his confidence the world of good coming on scoring. I thought it was poor though from Bournemouth. The commentator was making out as if in Cuckoo it was brilliant, like quick feet in the box, but
that was good strength.
There was too much strength, but the quick feet part I didn't really get, and there was two or three defenders around him. They should have dealt with that, they really should have, at that late stage in the game. But from Chelsea, it's been a decent enough start, Ruby. We spoke about the talent and the players. I think this manager is fairly good as well, Maresca. They've 7 points on the board now, they'll be quite happy, I suppose, with the return, and they do have some serious attacking talent. I think they can have a decent season, Chelsea.
I felt that, Robert. Haaland just did what Haaland did. City win 2-1.
No, he's
a monster.
Honestly, he's unreal. I actually think he might be better this season, which I'm not sure how that's even possible. But like, again, I saw him live against West Ham, and even though he doesn't influence the game from a 9 point of view, setting things up, but his touch did look better. It looked like he was more aware of his surroundings, and then when he goes through and goal, he's so clinical. Like the little dinks over the goalkeeper, his awareness. Like you look at the difference. Cavalier going through and goal, you're thinking, right, this is probably 40, 60 that he's going to miss you. And Haaland's gone through and gone, this is 99% sure he's going to score. Like there's no hesitation that he's going to miss the target. And it's just, at the moment, to have a player like that, like that's the difference between them and Arsenal, isn't it? I feel Arsenal could push them, but when you have a player like that up front and you have De Bruyne and people like that behind them, you kind of think, how do you stop that? It has to be the 115 charges against him. That's it.
Yeah, on that as well though, Stephen and Ruby, I felt that the defender was so poor. It's a pass from Ederson because he's so good at but he's in a 1v1 situation. Pinnock has to deal with that. He's so weak defensively, and I know Haaland's a big boy, but all he does is stand his ground and he nudges him off. And as Stephen says, once he goes through one-on-one, Ruby, there's no doubt he's going to score, and brilliant dink finish. But I think Pinnock, they'll be so disappointed.
Was Pinnock not watching the ball? Didn't even see Haaland. He just ran straight into the back of him.
Well, because obviously Haaland is trying to get in behind him, and Pinnock's in charge in that situation, as you say, and he's watching the ball. But once Haaland just stands his ground and bumps him, he has to be stronger. He should be bumping Haaland instead of the other way around. He was quite clever, Haaland, to be fair, but I think something like Romero at Gabriel yesterday as well has to be better in that situation defensively.
Yeah, I was laughing because I'm going to use an example to coach the under-12s team. I coached, showed him what not to do from a defender's point of view, because he gets caught ball watching. He doesn't see the man. And with Haaland, you can't get in a foot race with him. You have to think, right, I'm going to push up. I have to drop off a bit. Then I can go win it. It's just one of those things that he just gets completely wrong and gets punished.
Well, you're going to have to leave our Premier League discussion there. Just a couple of texts in.
You should have mentioned Fulham as well, just to really rub it into Stephen Kelly. Yeah, they should have won too.
Well, there's a point.
You just did. You just did.
Take the break now and leave him on that.
Fulham earn a point. Dogged Ipswich still look for a victory. Of course, with the Irish connection, Man United and the South Coast got a 3-0 win as well. Just in case people think we're ignoring Manchester City's charges, the hearing happened today at an undisclosed location. It's going to take up to 10 weeks, so there's actually no news to report on other than it has started. For now, Stephen Kelly, Alan Colley, thanks so much for joining us to chat football. We're taking a short ad break and then we're going to turn our attention to rugby in the company of former Ireland international Sharon Lynch.
Game on. Rugby.
Welcome back to Game On. So we're going to turn our attention to rugby, where Ireland women had a big win at the weekend over Australia, beating them 36-10. Former Ireland international Sharon Lynch is standing by to discuss. But first, let's hear from Captain Adele McMahon and Head Coach Scott Bimand, who spoke to Michael Cochrane after the match.
when you bring in a few people in from a few different places, obviously there's some girls that are coming up through. Someone like a Ruth gets her first cap today. Siobhan coming back in to our environment. Sevens girls coming into our environment. Probably the biggest thing is, and most important thing really, is we were looking to build more momentum than we had in the Six Nations. So we put a reasonable performance in, got a good result. We're really, really happy with that. We won't deny that. Scoreline, look, it's good, but we still feel we left the load out there, yeah. So there's plenty to go at.
From a point of view of a final match before the WXV, I mean, this is, I don't want to call it preparation, that's been disrespectful, but it's an ideal start.
Yeah, it is a perfect preparation, really. Not because it's a warm-up match, because it's we're playing against a fifth in the world, so effectively we're playing against a Tier 1 nation. We're playing at home. It's the 150 game. We've brought a good crowd. This stand was fantastic. The noise, the flags. We want to keep growing that. We want more people to come and see what we can do. Hopefully people leave that going, well, they've seen an Ireland winning performance. They've seen something they can get on the back of. They've seen tries up front. They've seen tries out wide and seen a couple of disallowed, which, you know, on another day get scored. So we're building. We're building it, and we want people to come with us. So hopefully we leave for Canada and fine fettle.
Adele McMahon, congratulations. You've a big broad smile on your face. What a fantastic performance, and I mean, that's reflected in the scoreline out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant. We've had a really hard 2 weeks of compete, a lot of information thrown at us, of, like I said, staff members coming in and adding value. So to turn that around that quickly and produce a performance like that from start to finish with four debuts in the mix, very, very proud of the girls. We had a clear plan heading into this game. We prepped the first week and the second week what we wanted to do come this Australian game, and it was the picture that we seen out there, and we went for we tacked in the mauls, the kicking game, territory. It seemed to play off today. The connections were really good. So, like I said, start to finish, unbelievable.
And all during the week, people have been talking about it's not just 1-15; it's, you know, 16-23 in terms of a match day squad. I mean, the impact from the bench was fantastic.
Yeah, huge. I mean, you've got four Olympians on the bench. Yeah. It's unbelievable. But it isn't just the 23 here. There's girls at home that didn't get an opportunity today who are just as good to be on the pitch, and that's the competition and depth that we need. That's what drives the game like that today for us. It's not just the people in the room; it's everyone else in the green wave.
So that was Ireland captain Adele McMahon, and before her, Ireland head coach Scott Beaman speaking to Michael Corcoran after the win over Australia in Belfast on Saturday. Now, we are joined by former Ireland international Sharon Lynch to look back on that win, 36 points to 10. Sharon, what's the most pleasing aspect for you of that victory for Ireland?
For me, watching the game, I was pleasantly surprised at that, the continuity, I suppose, from the cohesiveness from the Six Nations. I mean, the games that they played, I mean, they really kicked on from those, and I was pleased to see how that kind of the improvements kept coming. The girls seemed to really click together. I didn't know what to expect from this game. I mean, like, Australia is such a powerful side, even though they've had a rough probably 12 months, but I didn't know what to expect from them, and I didn't know what to expect from Ireland. So it was a real pleasing game to see how well they played. Like, six tries in any game is against any opposition is amazing. So look at that. I was delighted to see that they just pushed on from their Six Nations, and I'm just excited to see what's coming next.
Sharon, it was a really fast, aggressive start. 12 minutes, they were leading 12-5. Obviously Australia got one back quite quickly, but it was a really fast, aggressive start, and they set out with a purpose, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that seemed to be the agenda, I suppose, that everyone's just bursting, I mean, to get on the pitch and to see what they can do. But I suppose they played well in the intros. Everyone, I suppose, had a chance to play against each other, and there was a lot of battles there, and I suppose that they just had, so it's great to then kick on from game after game after game and then come on to this. So they're all really hot, and they're all really look excited to show what they can do. They know it's a World Cup year. They all have to prove themselves, as well. They all are fighting for positions. So, yeah, it went out all guns blazing. So that was really exciting to see.
You could almost see that intensity. There was 17-5 in front at half-time, and Scott Beaman, he wasn't long about making changes in the second half. Eve Higgins was only off the bench, and she scored a try. Everybody was trying to impress.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, I mean, bringing on 8 replacements in a game is hard to do. Like, it's hard to bring on players when they're playing well. And but obviously that seemed to me with the agenda from the outset, just gave everyone game time. Look, it's easy to do as well when you're six tries in or the game's going well. So I'm glad that he gave those subs a chance to come in, and like the game didn't seem to get any different from the replacements coming in. It really seemed to just step up and step up everyone that came in. There was no difference, so that was really pleasing to see as well. So everyone was probably delighted to get a few minutes, and then obviously some of the replacements got tries as well, so like that's just even better to see.
You mentioned, Sharon, that you didn't really know what to expect, and I think that was a general consensus going into this match for a lot of Irish rugby fans. Then you see the likes of Erin King making her Ireland debut, only a fourth senior game of 15s rugby. You have Aoife Wafer, only 21, two tries, the return of Eimear Considine, so that bit of experience. So that blend that perhaps Ireland have been searching for in a while now, like this win puts us up two places, the seventh in the world rankings. We were at the heavy heights of fourth in 2016. So is this the most cohesive perhaps this Ireland group is in quite some time?
Oh, absolutely. Look, there's no comparison between this team and, you know, 18 months ago, 2 years ago. Like, they're just, there's polar opposites. So, look, and that's the same as from, I suppose, the wins in the WX3, good Six Nations, you know, relatively good Six Nations wins at home. And then, I suppose, the good Interpros, and then coming back into camp together on a high, winning breeds winning mentality. Look, it's a World Cup year. They should all be excited. They should all be chomping at the bit to play, to get minutes, to, you know, just enjoy themselves like that. This year, you know, doesn't come around for many at all. So look, they all know, I think, the importance of the next few weeks to really kind of stamp their place on each position. But look, yeah, I mean, I'd love to see more experience in the side, but it isn't there. So the likes of Cliona Maloney coming in and the girls coming back, like they will give this kind of level headers and give them a bit of experience against the teams coming up. New Zealand and Canada and USA. So look, there, that's what you want to see in the squad. You want to see the blend of experience, and every game is just another big experience that they all have in their back pocket. And Aoife Wafer, like, what can you say about that? What that girl, like, the experience that she's gaining game in, game out is phenomenal. Her stats of that game were just outstanding. They're outrageous. Any player in any men or women's team would be delighted to what she did at the weekend.
Is Aoife a generational talent, or do we have to be careful of how much we big up such a young player?
I know, it's hard not to, because every game just seems to get better and better. But like, from what I can see, yeah, look, she reminds me of some of the girls I played with back in the day. Like, and you get excited to watch her. It's just her, it's not even the skill, like, her skill set is clearly there, but like, she's just so aggressive, her tenacious attitude for the game. Like, she seems to have just real love for it, and she's just everywhere. She just has no problem putting her hand up with tackling, with ball carries, and just getting around the pitch. Like, so look, what's not to love about a player like that? But it just gives everyone else then the platform to work off. Like, we see someone else working hard, it just ups the ante, and it keeps that attitude going. So that's what you want to see.
What would you like to see from the 3-match tour they're about to go on in Canada, New Zealand on the 29th, Canada on the 5th of October, and the USA on the 11th? What would you like to see from that tour?
Look, it's going to be hard not to get a bit overwhelmed by the likes of New Zealand. Like, it'd be hard not to do that. They're human at the end of the day, playing against some of the top sides in the world. But I'd like to say that they take the opportunities. They don't dip ahead if things go wrong or don't go their way. That they keep positive, learn from their experiences. Like, this experience to go to Canada, number one, to get these games in their back pocket before a World Cup year. Like, no team before them has had this opportunity. So I hope that they all take it with both hands and really enjoy it, but learn from every game. On the pitch, I suppose, like, defence, I just want to keep improving, because I think that's going to be the main how it dictates us with how we play against other teams in the World Cup. Whoever we come against, the defence has to be just the main part of our game. And so set pieces as well, I'd love to see them just keep improving, because I thought the weekend they were the difference between us and Australia. So and at the Six Nations, like, they weren't the best, so to keep those improving, and they will. The more they gel together, the more they play together, and more training, and with the likes of the backroom team that they have there, and like some Maz Riley in their armoury, they can't not but improve in that regard. So yeah, but ultimately enjoy the experience, because not everyone gets to play against these teams in a place like Canada.
Obviously, they've been together for a while now, a couple of weeks, but that game up against America on the 11th of October is over 4 weeks away. Mm-hmm. How valuable is that much time together to them?
oh, stop. Like, it's unbelievable. Like, every week, every day they get together as a group is so valuable. And I do, from what I hear, they seem to be cherishing it and relishing it. And they all seem to get on well. Look, that's something that like, you can't buy that kind of experience. You can't buy the gelling together, the like being around, the downtime and what they do together. And I'd like to think that the IRFU will make sure that time is well spent and keep them entertained and keep them working hard together. The USA game, yeah, it's a few weeks away, but like that's going to be the game that they're going to target, I'd imagine, to really get a good win and a display from that game. And anything they get from New Zealand, Canada will be bonuses.
Well, here's hoping the Irish women's rugby team continue on that positive trajectory for their trip to Vancouver. For now, we'll leave the conversation there. Sharon Lynch, thanks so much for joining us.
Game on.
Golf.
Now, Brian Keogh, golf writer with the Irish Independent, joins us now to finish the show chatting about golf, because Rory McIlroy has vowed to become a winner again soon and insisted his Irish Open near miss has only made him more determined to get the job done at next year's Open Championship at Royal Portrush. However, Brian, it is a lot of near misses in the last 3 months for Rory McIlroy. How do you feel he will respond to this one?
Yeah, I mean, it is a difficult one, isn't it? I suppose, looking on the bright side, if you're Rory McIlroy, you're saying, well, I'm putting myself up there all the time, you know, and if you're putting yourself up there all the time, you're bound to get a win or two sooner or later. But yeah, not getting over the line, you know, has become a little bit of a problem for Rory this year. Obviously, the US Open was the big one. He also had a chance in the Olympic Games. And on Sunday, he was really, really looking forward to winning, you know, in Northern Ireland for the first time, and just didn't quite get it done. A combination of, you know, mistakes from Rory and a brilliant final round from Rasmus Højgaard.
Can you pinpoint what isn't clicking, or is it just a host of small issues?
Yeah, well, it's been a little bit similar to what happened to him in the US Open. You know, it's either hitting the wrong shot at the wrong time or having a mistake on the greens at the wrong time. It just generally seems to be that. Maybe a little bit of focus, you know, his focus certainly in the final round of the US Open. I think he's, you know, admitted to that he usually gets in his own little world. He wasn't in his own little world during that final round in Pinehurst. He was looking around, looking where Bryson DeChambeau was, who was playing just behind him, looking to see what he had to do. So, you know, a little bit of focus. Obviously, a lot of pressure on Rory to end that, you know, that long gap between major wins as well. So, you know, I think he feels the pressure. I mean, he has had three wins this year, so he does get those wins still consistently. But in the big events, the ones that he really, really wants, you know, the majors, the Irish Open, events like that, he just hasn't been able to get over the line.
9 on a Sunday. I definitely don't know. But technically, is he doing anything different?
I don't think his swing has been quite where he wants it to be this year. And certainly, you know, having seen, you know, Michael Bannon for the last week or so at home in County Down, he certainly seemed to be swinging the club beautifully on Sunday. And even after the mistake on the 15th, where he missed the green pretty much from just off the edge of the fairway, you know, he hits a superb drive on 16, you know, superb drive on 17, and a great second shot. It was just the putt was the problem to a very dangerous pin, and then two fantastic shots on 18. So, you know, technically, you'd have to say, you know, it's all there. It just seems to be, you know, focus and, you know, guys coming out and playing and putting it up to him at the right time. He had Cam Smith in the Open Championship, obviously, in St. Andrews there a couple of years ago, where he had a fantastic putting around. Wyndham Clark in the US Open as well, you know, playing really well. And then Rasmus Højgaard, or DeChambeau and Rasmus Højgaard there on Sunday. You know, unbelievable final round from Højgaard, really coming home in 31. 7 birdies in the last 10. So, you know, it's not always up to you, but certainly I'd be positive that he's putting himself up there, but a little bit worried about the focus, and it seems to be taking a lot more extra looks at the hole these days than he perhaps did in the past.
Brian, I'm conscious time is against us. Just briefly before we let you go, at the Solheim Cup, your captain, Susan Peterson, declined to reveal why Leona Maguire played just twice and insisted she had no regrets following her side's loss to the United States in Virginia. Can you understand perhaps why Leona wasn't front and centre considering the form she went into the Solheim Cup with?
Well, she didn't go in fantastic form. Yeah. She hadn't had a top 10 in a stroke play event all year. Didn't play particularly well, you know, in the Irish Women's Open. So she wasn't in very good form. But at the same time, you know, she's an absolute beast in the match play events. Obviously, she got to the final of the match play in the States this year. Nelly Korda, you know, she ran into a buzzsaw that day. So, you know, she's got a fantastic record, only 2 defeats in 10 matches. So really, it's like leaving out Ian Poulter, isn't it? It's one of those captaining decisions that, you know, you live and die by. And I think, you know, Pedersen will maybe regret that one.
Perhaps. Okay, great stuff. Brian Keogh, golf writer with the Irish Independent. Thanks so much, Chair, for joining us. Ruby, before we finish up, actually, the only horse race event run on a beach under the Irish Rules of Racing. It's only once a year. It's happening at the moment. Laytown Races. It's a proper unique event.
Irish Rules of Racing. I'd say it can go beyond Irish Rules of Racing. Shane,
that's their Twitter bio, Ruby, I must say.
Twitter bio, right? There's definitely no race course on the beach in the UK. I don't remember seeing too many in France either. But it is, look, I'm not going to call it a novelty because it is a proper race meeting. It's run on the beach. When the tide goes out, they build the race course. They run the races before the tide comes back in.
That is magical. Magical stuff. Okay, great stuff. Ruby is back tomorrow with Marie for some magical stuff. Sport from 6 to 7 on Game On. Don't go anywhere because we're going to take a short ad break, check in with the news desk. But up next, there is the magical new music show with the one and only Dermot O'Brien. Cannot wait for that one, so do not go anywhere. Big thanks to Ronan Lawler and Laura Lee Davis for working on this evening's show. Ruby's back, as I mentioned, tomorrow from 6 o'clock with Marie. I'll speak to you again Thursday. From all of us here at Game On, is bye for now.